we're still looking at a description of the Kerr horizon in the language that we developed to describe any null hypersurface. So just to summarize where we were as of this morning, so we're introducing intrinsic coordinates on the horizon. The first one is the parameter v that's going to be running along the generators. So I write it as v instead of lambda. And then we have two angles that are defined as we do for null surfaces. They're defined to be constant on the null generators. So we looked into that. We have the embedding relations that give us the relationship between the intrinsic coordinates and the space-time coordinates. The space-time coordinates in this regular coordinate system that we talked about are v, r, theta, and psi, psi angle being a related version of the angle relative to the original phi coordinate. And then the embedding relations just say that v is equal to v, r is equal to a constant on the horizon, theta is equal to itself, and then we have this relationship here between the psi angle and the chi angle that is now constant on each null generator, but the psi angle on each generator, of course, increases with v. From the embedding relations, we can get a basis of tangent vectors on the horizon, and if we need it, we won't need it for today's lecture, if we need it, we could complete the basis with a second null vector that would be piercing across the event horizon. So the tangent vectors, one is going to be tangent to the null generators, and the other ones are pointing from generator to generator. And then we have those quantities that we talked about, the angular velocity of the event horizon, the surface gravity, and then the radius of the event horizon. Okay, so we can do all sorts of things with this, but for the purpose of this discussion, I want to look at the induced metric on the horizon. And that's a metric that's been defined, in the full formalism that we developed. That's a metric that is two-dimensional. It's really a metric on the cross-sections of the horizon. And the way we defined this was that this was given by all the scalar products between the two vectors that are pointing from generator to generator that are both orthogonal to the k vector. So those are the only non-vanishing components that remain for the induced metric. And I won't do the calculation here in real time, but if you calculate this, you're going to find that, well, there are two non-vanishing components, so the metric is diagonal. The theta-theta component is equal to r plus squared plus a squared cosine squared theta. And the, chi-chi component, that's equal to r plus squared plus a squared, all squared divided by r plus squared plus a squared cosine squared theta, and that multiplies sine squared theta. So as I said before, if we look at the components of the metric, we find that there's certainly a theta dependence, and that's a notion that at least it gives us an indication that the geometry of the horizon is not spherically symmetric. It would be spherically symmetric if the dependence on theta was removed, but we have it. Now, here we're still working with coordinates, so we can't really prejudge too much of the nature of the geometry by just looking at metric components, but what you could do from the two-dimensional metric is to calculate the Ricci curvature, for example, that would describe the curvature, intrinsic curvature of the event horizon, and that's a simple exercise using this metric, and you would find that the Ricci curvature certainly does depend on theta. So here, that's a more geometrical statement about the fact that the geometry is not spherically symmetric. So, a way to sort of suggest that on the diagram is the fact that, well, if we were dealing with a spherical black hole, a Schwarzschild black hole, the geometry of the event horizon would be spherically symmetric. But here, because we're dealing with a rotating black hole, as you would expect for any rotating body, there's a bit of a bulge that takes place because of the rotation. And that gives rise to a non-spherical geometry. So in a very real sense, we're talking about an object, you know, a structure, geometric structure that has a flattening of the poles, a bulging of the equator. And that's something that, well, is not terribly surprising in view of the rotation of the event horizon. But that's something that can be determined, you know, meaningfully in geometrical terms, in terms of the induced metric and geometrical quantities that you can derive from that, including the full Riemann tensor, two-dimensional Riemann tensor that reduces down to just one independent component, and we can relate that to the Ricci scalar or the Gaussian curvature. If we calculate the metric determinant from that, it's just basically multiplying those two things together. We get a nice simplification that occurs here, and after we take the square root, we get r plus squared plus a squared multiplying sine theta. All right, so with that two metric, you know, we can do various things, like measure the cross-sectional area of the event horizon. And in geometrical terms, what we mean by that is that we have our null surface, and we have the congruence of null generators. By cross-sectional area, what I mean is that I take a cross-section of the congruence, namely, I take a cut across constant values of v, or lambda, so constant value of the parameter. So this is v equals 1, v equals 1, v equals 1. And the metric that we've just talked about here is a metric that's defined on those cross-sections. And by integrating over the full range of the two angles, theta and chi, by basically integrating over all the generators, I can calculate the total area of the event horizon. So the total area is just going to be the integral of the area element on that cross-section. And all that we have to do is to plug in the square root of the determinant and just recall the usual ranges for our angular coordinates. So this is a constant that factorizes. We can pull it out of the integral. And then we have the usual integral of sine theta d phi over the, you know, the usual ranges of the coordinates. And that gives us a nice factor of 4 pi. So bottom line with all of this is that the area of the event horizon, or a cross-section thereof, is equal to 4 pi r squared, r plus squared plus a squared. And that we can write, you know, in this way, or I could just rewrite it as 8 pi m r plus. So it's according to your taste. But I think that's a nice form, so we might as well play with that. So the area of the Kerr black hole is equal to 8 pi m r plus. And I can write r plus as m plus square root of m squared minus a squared. But just to make a point here, I'm going to write it as j over m squared. So to express the area directly in terms of the basic parameters of the Kerr solution, namely the mass and angular momentum parameter. So that's a calculation that we could do as a very natural extension of the formalism that we developed. So that's what, you know, that's what it's good for. We didn't need to do necessarily all of that, but one thing that we certainly needed to do in order to define the induced metric on the event horizon was to deal with a regular coordinate system. So the switch from Bourdieu-Lindquist coordinates TR theta phi to the well-behaved coordinates VR theta psi, if you can follow that, that was strictly necessary to define a well-defined metric on the event horizon. And after that, you know, everything could follow pretty easily. But I think all of this stuff, you know, follows nicely under the, you know, formalism of null hypersurfaces that we've been developing in this course. So it all comes together, I think, very nicely. Okay. couple of more things I'm going to say about this, because I think that pretty much wraps up our description of the event horizon. So I think by now we have a pretty good understanding of the meaning of the Kerr spacetime and what rotation does. And we have a pretty complete description of the event horizon. But there is a couple of things that we can unravel from this area relation that turns out to have pretty deep consequences, deep significance, when we start comparing the laws of black hole mechanics to the laws of thermodynamics. And that's been, of course, a big theme in the physics of black holes since the early 70s. So one ramification of this, one consequence of this, is the fact that we have a differential law. Coming out of all of this. And what I mean is, okay, we have very explicitly here, we have the statement that the area of a black hole is a very specific function of the two parameters that describe a black hole, namely M and J. And that's the explicit form of the function. If we have that, well, we have the statement also that if we take differences between two situations, a black hole with slightly different parameters being compared to the original black hole. So we have two black holes. So we have black hole number one with parameters M and J, and we have black hole number two with slightly different values of M and J. So if we compare two black holes like this with slightly different parameters, then it's obvious by taking a derivative that we will get a slightly different area between the two black holes. And we can calculate that change in area by simply taking the partial derivatives. So if we just take the partial derivatives, we will have the relationship between the change in area and the change in the two parameters M and J. And then it's just a matter of doing the calculation. Here's the area. Take a partial derivative with respect to M. Take a partial derivative with respect to J and see what comes out of this. And what comes out of that is something that is, in fact, related to all those quantities that we introduced along the way. So it's just a matter of doing straightforward calculations. And what we find when we do this is that, let's see if I have it in my notes here. Well, I'll just write it like this. I'll just rewrite. So I evaluate all of those things, those partial derivatives. And after I'm done, I try to recognize them, in terms of the quantities that were pre-discussed, in the morning lecture. And what I find is that if I multiply by kappa over 8 pi, then what I find is that that relation here becomes dm minus omega h dj. So what I'm saying here is that, well, this partial derivative here turns out to be 8 pi over kappa. So if we did the calculation, we would see that this is how it's coming out. And then this partial derivative here would be minus omega h divided by that. And that's basically just the outcome of the calculation, that all of those things, those partial derivatives here can be re-expressed in terms of known quantities. So we could leave it at that, and the interpretation would be naturally that if I change the mass, change the angular momentum, there's going to be some resulting changes in the area, and the formula would give us, that related change. So that would be one way of interpreting this. Another way of interpreting that would be to solve for dm, and now we're going to sort of change the point of view a little bit. So I'm going to re-express this same equation. It's exactly the same equation, but now I'm going to express it, in terms of dm being equated to kappa over 8 pi dA plus omega h dj. Same equation, but now the interpretation is going to be slightly different, as I said, because while I can look at this in various ways, I can look at this as a mathematical expression of the fact that instead of looking at the area as a function of mass and angular momentum, which I think from a physical point of view is the most, you know, is a pretty natural thing to do. I can invert this and think of M as being a function of area and J. So instead of specifying mass and angular momentum, I could think of specifying my black hole by choosing an area and choosing an angular momentum. And then if I were to invert this for M, which can be done, by the way, if I inverted that equation for M, we could actually write down this function and consider the mass to be a derived quantity once we assumed an area and an angular momentum. So that's just a slight, I mean, it's the same equation, but with a slightly different interpretation. And mathematically speaking, we would identify this coefficient here as the partial derivative of A with respect to M. And we would identify this as a partial derivative also. So in the new interpretation, kappa over A pi would be interpreted as a partial derivative of the mass with respect to A keeping J fixed. It's important when we talk about partial derivatives to really be clear on what is being varied and what is being kept fixed. And then omega H would be interpreted as the partial derivative of M with respect to J. And the point of view here is that A and J are going to be the independent parameters of the black hole. Now, the reason to look at this in this way is because it's starting to look like a first law of thermodynamics. Now, you know, there's a big story about, you know, how this realization that black holes were thermodynamic systems, you know, how that came about and how, you know, the Hawking discovery of Hawking radiation was pretty key into that. I'm not going to describe all of this. And, you know, there's a temptation. So regardless of that story, there's a temptation to look at an identity like this as being something that looks like a first law of thermodynamics. In thermodynamics, we would have the internal energy of the system being related to external parameters like volume and maybe angular momentum if we're talking about the thermodynamic system that rotates. And it's a pretty usual thing when you do thermodynamics with rotating systems that the partial derivative of the internal energy with respect to angular momentum is in fact related to the angular velocity of that rotating body. So that's something that tends to emerge in discussions of thermodynamics of rotating systems. And, but, you know, other than that, you know, the idea of a first law of thermodynamics is that you have some measure of internal energy that's being related to changes in external parameters. And here, well, we say that the mass of the black hole is a measure of its internal energy. That seems a natural identification to make. And then if the mass depends on external parameters specified by A and J, then, you know, that's the kind of relationship that you would get. And it's fairly natural to have the rotating, the rotational angular velocity to be the conjugate variable to J. And then what we've identified here is, you know, A as an external parameter and kappa over A pi as a conjugate variable in the sense of what we normally do in thermodynamics. Now, from that, it's sort of, you know, one quick step removed to reinterpret the area term here as a TdS term, because the internal energy of a thermodynamic system is usually a function of its entropy and whatever else is a relevant external parameter. And if you could somehow justify the association of area with entropy, you would, in the same step, justify the identification of kappa, the surface gravity of the black hole, with temperature of the black hole. Well, I think you know the story. So initially, you know, that was proposed, and then a lot of people sort of dismiss it altogether because, you know, if you're talking about black holes, you're not talking about a thermodynamic object. And if you really want to assign a temperature to a black hole, well, the only sensible thing to do would be to assign it zero temperature, because the black hole will always absorb, will never emit. And that's exactly like a body at zero temperature. And then, you know, come 1975 or 74, and Hawking discovers the phenomenon of pair creation around black holes coming from quantum mechanics, and then found that, in fact, there is such a thing as a black hole temperature. And that black hole temperature is given precisely by, you know, by the surface gravity apart from that numerical factor. I think I got the, yeah, no, that's fine. Apart from that factor of 8 pi. So this association between thermodynamics and the laws of black hole mechanics, which at the start was just a purely mathematical relationship between black hole parameters, well, now that started to take hold, and you know, there's a lot of, you know, very important ramifications of this with respect to fundamental physics. So what is the meaning of black hole entropy? You know, we have inequality with area, but you know, what's the meaning of this? And you know, what are the statistical mechanics descriptions of all of this? I mean, all of those questions that were, you know, posed at the time, came to the fore at the time, are still being debated today. So it's been a very rich area for people to argue about when they do theoretical physics. So I'm not going to dwell on this, but I'm just going to say that, you know, there's something, you know, very appealing about this. But ultimately, you know, if you don't care about all of the stuff that I just described, what we have here is an equation that's basically a relationship between how two parameters of the black hole, so how the, you know, the fundamental parameters describing the black hole, which we choose to be A and J, how a change in them will produce a change in mass. So that's basically what it all boils down to, you know, if we strip away all the cool stuff, you know, having to do with Hawking radiation and the real association with thermodynamics. So anyway, so the point of view I'm going to take here is to not, you know, get carried away with all this stuff, which would be easy to do, and just look at this as an identity followed, you know, that follows from the Einstein field equations through the Kerr metric. And that simply expresses the fact that if we change the parameters of the black hole, we have to change the mass as well. And that's not a terribly surprising, you know, surprising conclusion. Okay, so that's one thing. And it turns out that, okay, here we, you know, relied very specifically on the properties of the Kerr metric to derive this relation. So that relied very specifically on the Kerr solution. Later on, perhaps, you know, probably not today, but next week, we're going to see a version of this, a generalization of this, that would describe exactly the same sort of idea, but now for a black hole that's, you know, that's not a Kerr black hole. So going back to those situations I was talking about before, if we imagine that the black hole is put in the presence of matter, the metric outside the black hole is no longer going to be Kerr because the matter will change the curvature of space-time outside the black hole. But yet there's going to be a relation like this that holds regardless, and we can derive it without, you know, a detailed knowledge of the metric. We can work this out very elegantly based on very powerful ideas that come from, you know, asymptotic structure and the Einstein field equations without having to write down what the metric actually is. So there's something very, very deep about this, and we'll, you know, we'll come to unravel that. So there's one more thing that I want to say about this, and that has to do with taking this differential equation here, so to speak, and integrating it. So there's an integral version to that differential law. So let's call it the integral law. And I could derive it algebraically based, again, on all those properties of the Kerr metric. But it turns out that there's a much more fundamental point of view to give to this that gives us the answer without the need to do any algebra. So it's quite beautiful. So before I get into that, let me recall something that you may have seen before but may not have. So it doesn't matter. I'm going to do a discussion of this. It's called the Euler theorem on homogeneous functions. So it's a very nice theorem. So what's a homogeneous function? So suppose that we have a function of several variables. Doesn't matter how many. And suppose that this function has the following property, that if you rescale all of those variables by a factor lambda, then the function itself will rescale by some factor, some power of lambda, with respect to what it used to be. So if that function satisfies that property, then it's called a homogeneous function of degree k. So that defines a homogeneous function of degree k. All right. So that's just the definition, but as a consequence, the theorem states that k times f is going to be equal to a sum over all the variables, xa times the a derivative of f. So a homogeneous function automatically satisfies that differential relation. And it's actually easy to prove. Just take the definition, differentiate with respect to lambda, and evaluate the result at lambda equals 1. If we do that on the right-hand side, differentiate with respect to lambda, we're going to get k multiplying lambda to the k minus 1. Evaluate this at lambda equals 1, we get k times f. That's the left-hand side. Do it on the left-hand side here. Differentiate with respect to lambda means that we have to differentiate with respect to all the arguments and differentiate the arguments with respect to lambda. So the derivative of the argument with respect to lambda gives us the xa. All the derivative with respect to all the arguments gives us those partial derivatives, and then we set lambda equals to 1. So very simple differential property of homogeneous functions, and the statement is that if we have this, then we have that. And another way of saying this is that if we know that f is homogeneous, if we have this, then we have that. Now, let's look at that relation over here, and let's try to decide whether m is a homogeneous function. And I will claim, and I think I will justify the fact that it is. So let's think about units here. M has units of length. Area has units of length squared. And angular momentum in relativistic units has units of length squared as well, if you think about it. If you think back to A, you know, J being equal to A times M, A had units of length multiplied by M units of length, we have a J that has units of length squared. Okay, so M is a function of A and J. And let's think of what would happen to M if we were to rescale our length unit by a factor lambda. So what if we take our length unit, multiply, what I meant by this is that suppose that we rescale A and J by a factor lambda. Well, that would be analogous to rescaling our length unit by a factor of lambda to the 1/2. And then because M has a unit of length, that has to be exactly the same as rescaling the length by that same factor. So what I'm saying here is that just by dimensional analysis, because of the units of things, if I rescale the area by a factor of lambda and rescale the angular momentum by a factor of lambda, that's basically just the same as rescaling our choice of unit by a factor of lambda to the 1/2. And if I choose to do that, the mass itself will be rescaled by that same factor of lambda to the 1/2. So just by dimensional analysis like this, we can conclude that M is a homogeneous function of degree 1/2. And according to Euler's theorem, we can express k times the function, namely 1/2 times the mass, as a sum like this, where now we have a sum over two independent variables, a and j. So the first term is going to be a that multiplies the partial derivative of m with respect to a. And then we have j multiplying the partial derivative with respect to j. But we know what these are. The partial derivative of m with respect to a, that's kappa divided by a pi, and that will multiply a. And the other partial derivative is omega h. And that multiplies j. So multiply through by 2, and we get the integral version of that differential law. And we get it for free just by appealing to the homogeneity of the function as a function of a and j, the mass function as a function of a and j. So here, after multiplying by 2, we get kappa over 4 pi multiplying a plus 2 omega h multiplying j. So that's sometimes known as the SMAR formula. And it's basically just an algebraic relation between the mass and all of those other quantities that we came across in our description of the Kerr horizon. And you know, that's something that you could have derived based on all those algebraic relations that we got, namely plug in what we had for kappa, plug in what we have for a, plug in what we had for omega h, plug in, well, j is what it is. And if you just work out the right-hand side by plugging all those results that we obtained before, you'll find that all sorts of things cancel out very nicely, and the outcome is going to be m. So that's something we could have expressed, you know, and derived purely on the basic of all this Kerr knowledge that we have. But I really wanted to highlight the fact that we have something a lot more fundamental here that comes about because we have a differential law, and we have this this homogeneity, relation that is guaranteed on us by just dimensional analysis, just coming from the dimensionality of all those basic quantities. So it's quite nice, and it's something that, well, that kind of game is played a lot. So, you know, whenever you can write down a differential law like this, chances are that you can convert it to an integral law like this, and in thermodynamics it's done all the time. That's how you derive the Gibbs-Duhem relation among thermodynamic variables. So it's a pretty powerful, you know, mathematical game that you can play, and you know, it it brings very interesting information to you when you do that. Okay, any questions about this? Okay, so that was advertising, basically, because we're going to re-encounter this later on in our discussion of general black holes. So we're going to see that something like this, but modified, will emerge on us again. And we're going to see that the Kerr result is, you know, a very special case of something a lot more general. So I just wanted to, highlight that before we get there. All right. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say about the Kerr solution and the Kerr black hole. And what I want to do now, and that's going to be the last portion of the course, and I think that will take us through the lectures next week very nicely, is to generalize the whole situation. And that's where I'm going to really think about a black hole not being in isolation in vacuum, but being in the presence of some matter. And that would be a situation where, unless we have a very detailed model for the distribution of matter outside the black hole, this is not a situation where we can write down an explicit metric for the black hole plus matter. I mean, it's too complicated for us to be able to do that and hope to be able to write down a metric. So if we want to work out some properties of black holes in that generalized context, well, we have to work a little bit harder and give up on the notion that we can do all of this from the knowledge of a metric. We have to be, we have to be more creative than that. And that's what we'll go into now. All right. Before I get into that, let me just recall a bit with a bit more detail this description of null hypersurfaces, because now we're going to really make use of that technology in a big way. So let's go back to null hypersurfaces. Just a recap of what we talked about previously. So just to summarize the main results that we're going to need next, and that's where all the this full apparatus is going to come to its own here. We're gonna apply it big time. So, I mean, all of this we've seen before, so I just want to summarize very quickly. So that's the same picture I had before. We have a null surface. We have the null generators to that surface. We have intrinsic coordinates. We have a parameter v that runs along the geodesic, so all of that stuff that we talked about over there. So we have intrinsic coordinates v and theta a. We have, v being the running parameter, theta a being the constant labels on the geodesics. We have the tangent vector coming along with the embedding relations. So all of this we just talked about. And what we also have is a second null vector that we can use to complete the basis. So given k, given e, there's going to be a fourth vector that's going to satisfy all the conditions that we want, and we're going to have a very nice null basis. So k is a null vector. K is orthogonal to all the e vectors. And we're introducing the null vector to be null itself. And normalize such that the inner product with k is minus 1 and orthogonal to all the e vectors as well. So we have a nice basis that we can use on the null surface. We have an induced metric. We have transport equations. So we've talked about all of this before. So we have an equation that tells us that k satisfies the geodesic equation in affine, in non-affine parameter form. And we also have transport equations for the e vectors that we derived previously, or at least discussed that. And that's given in terms of a quantity omega a multiplying k plus bab multiplying e alpha a. I'm raising the capital Latin indices here with respect to the omega inverse metric. BAB was something that was given by the transverse projection of the gradient of k, something that we could split up into a trace piece and a trace-free piece that we call the shear tensor, and that's something that happened to be equal to the v derivative of the induced metric. So all of this we talked about in our previous discussion of null hypersurfaces. There's a related result to this. If I take the trace of that equation here, I get that the expansion, namely the trace of B, is something I can relate to the v derivative of the metric determinant under the square root. So I can write it like this. And something else that we worked out is that the rate of change of a cross-sectional area could be expressed as an integral of theta, the expansion parameter. And ds, of course, is just the area element on that cross-section expressed in terms of those intrinsic coordinates. So yeah, so that reinforces the notion that the theta scalar is the fractional rate of change of cross-sectional area. And if we integrate it, then we get, of course, the rate of change of that area. Okay, so we had worked all of this out. And then there's a bit more stuff along those lines. So let me leave this here for now, and I'll go over here. A few other things that we're going to be using. So we had a few things regarding integration, and we're going to need that in the development. So the surface element on the null surface, that's something that we talk quite a bit about. That's something we can relate to the normal vector k alpha times dv times the same ds I wrote down before. So that's the hypersurface integral. The area element on a cross section is something that we can express as this ds alpha beta. And that's an antisymmetric structure. And that will involve the two normals to the cross section, namely k and n, in this antisymmetric combination. And other than that, we just do a ds integral. ds is the same that we had over here. So we have that. And we also had two equations that were the null analog of the Gauss-Kodaczky equations. And there's a number of those, but there's two of them in particular that turn out to be important and useful. One having to do with the KK component of the Ricci tensor. And that's something we can express in terms of the V derivative of the expansion scalar. There's a kappa theta term. There's a minus theta squared term. And then there's a squared shear term. And that's just a statement of Rachow-Dury's equation. But in a slightly different form, because here we're allowing the parameterization of the null generators to be non-affine. So we get this extra kappa term because we're not using an affine parameterization. So that was one of our equations. And then there was the other one having to do with the KE component of the Ricci scalar. And that's given by the V derivative of that omega quantity that we defined over there in the transport equations. And then we have a derivative of the kappa quantity with respect to the, to the generator labels. Then we have a derivative of theta, the expansion scalar with respect to the generator labels. We have the covariant derivative of the shear tensor with respect to those coordinates. And then we have a theta times omega A. So that's something that I wrote down before when we were talking about the Gauss-Kodaczky equations in the case of a null hypersurface. I didn't derive them, but they basically follow just the same sort of calculation that we did for, you know, time-like and space-like surfaces when we derived those Gauss-Kodaczky equations. In those cases, they're basically analogous to that. Okay. So what I'm saying here is that, well, all of this stuff that I just summarized applies to any null hypersurface. And because the event horizon is a null hypersurface, all of those equations relate directly to the physics of an event horizon, whether or not it's described by the Kerr metric. So anything that qualifies as an event horizon for a black hole that may not be in isolation and may not be described by the Kerr metric, all of this stuff applies to that. So it's really the right formalism to describe what happens in very general terms to any event horizon. So very powerful stuff. And of course, that's why I spent all this time working through that in previous lectures. So any questions about all of this? Should all be pretty familiar. Okay, good. So let's talk about this idea of generalizing the situation to non-vacuum black holes. Sorry, that's what I wanted to keep. Okay, so let's talk about a general black hole. And then I'm going to specialize it to a stationary black hole in pretty short order, but let's talk about a more general situation first. So suppose that we have a black hole, so something happened at some point and gravitational collapse produced a black hole. But let's suppose that instead of being in isolation in vacuum, we have a black hole surrounded by matter. So we have some form of matter. And if we're talking about very, very general situations, well, I might be talking about an accretion disk around a black hole. And in that accretion disk, there might be all sorts of phenomena going on. You know, the hydrodynamics of this would be very complicated. There might be internal turbulence going on. There might be, you know, magnetic fields that are at play there. Some of the matter might actually fall toward the black hole. So, you know, to have any, you know, hope of discussing this in terms of simple metrics we can write down is completely hopeless. I mean, the Kerr black hole by itself is pretty simple, but it's already, you know, something. To try to put matter on top of this and describe the metric that would describe, you know, a situation like this would be pretty hopeless. So the matter could be time dependent. You know, it could be orbiting around a black hole. It could be falling inside a black hole. So that black hole would not be a Kerr black hole. It would be described by, you know, a metric that would depend on time, that would not be axisymmetric because the matter around may not be axisymmetric. So it would be very complicated. And it's so complicated, and in fact, you know, the only hope you have at describing something like this would be through numerical simulations, where you set up the matter, set up the magnetic fields, make sure that your simulation incorporates all of the relevant equations of motion for the matter, and then you would see what the matter does in terms of falling down toward a black hole. You would see what the black hole does in terms of reacting to all of this. And, you know, people do numerical simulations where all of this is, you know, is described, but it's very complicated. And, you know, it takes us pretty far outside of what we might be able to do in terms of simple description. So let's not contemplate doing anything quite so dramatic. What I'm going to do is to still allow for the presence of matter around the space-time, but now I'll insist that that the matter is stationary, that my black hole space-time, in fact, doesn't depend on time. So it's a rather severe description compared to what really happens astrophysically. But if we're going to be describing this mathematically, we have to make some choices, and I'm going to impose that restriction. So let's talk about a much tamer version of all of this, where the black hole is still not isolated, but we required that it be stationary. And what I mean by that is that nothing in my space-time depends on time. So we could still have a black hole. We could still have a presence of matter around. But now, by choice, and because we have to do something like this, we're going to impose a condition that everything is time independent. Okay. Now, this is still very different from a Kerr black hole because the matter outside can be, you know, can have a lot of mass associated with it. The space-time would be a very strong deviation from the, you know, from the Kerr metric because the Kerr metric only applies in vacuum. So this is not a Kerr black hole. The matter is changing the nature of the space-time significantly. I don't want to, you know, make any assumption about how strongly it could deviate from Kerr. I'm just going to say that it's simply not a Kerr black hole. But I will be insisting that it's a stationary black hole. And I'm going to appeal to my old friend Stephen Hawking, who started to study that sort of thing back in the early 70s, and he came up with a very remarkable theorem. Couple of things. It's a very dense paper that he wrote. Sometimes I try to read it and I get, completely lost very quickly. But the main outcomes are these. If the black hole is stationary, it must be either static. And by static, what we mean is that there's going to be a time-like killing vector, which we already have, but a time-like killing vector that's hypersurface orthogonal. And if you remember that discussion, that means that the omega quantity, the antisymmetric part of the gradient of T, so let me just say that this is the antisymmetric part of the gradient of T, had to be zero. So that's what it would mean for the black hole to be static or axially symmetric. And what this means is that, well, we could still have a time-like killing vector that's not hypersurface orthogonal, but we would have in that case a second killing vector that would be the one associated with the axial symmetry of the spacetime. So what Hawking was able to prove is that if you impose the condition of stationarity, then you're forced to either or two possibilities. Either it's going to be a static spacetime, in which case it's a lot more than just being stationary because of that extra condition on the killing vector, or it's going to be stationary and axisymmetric. No way out of this. Stationary buys you all of that. And that's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing because if we, reject the static case because that's a little bit too, too simple, if we go for the axisymmetric outcome, then we have a spacetime that started out with just one killing vector and now automatically has a second one. And it turns out there's more to it than that. So I'm going to try to explain why, because that seems very radical and that seems very, almost too much. We're going to look into the physical reason why this has to be. But before I do that, let me consider the second part of Hawking's theorem. What Hawking was able to prove in that paper is that the combination, the linear combination of those two killing vectors with a constant omega h, that itself is a killing vector, so a linear combination of killing vectors is a killing vector. The linear combination is null on the black hole horizon. So it behaves just as the vector k that we've been talking about in the specific context of the Kerr, except that we're not dealing with a Kerr spacetime, and the omega h may not be equal to the Kerr value because the spacetime is not the Kerr spacetime. But what this means is that already we have a lot of the structure that we had in Kerr for free just based on the assumption of having a stationary situation where you have a black hole and potentially a lot of mass around the black hole. The stationarity assumption is buying you all of this. And, if it's offered to us like this, we can use it, and we're going to use it, to basically rederive a lot of the stuff that we've seen before, but now well outside of the context of a Kerr black hole, in the context of any stationary black hole that would have, for example, a distribution of matter outside the black hole, and therefore a metric that's not the Kerr metric. So that's where we're going with this. So I'm not going to prove any of this, but I want to, to sort of motivate where this is coming from, because that seems, that seems very, very, constraining. This assumption of being stationary seems to be constraining way too much. And the reason why it works like this, so why does stationary give rise to axisymmetry. So I'm going to take just the second possibility here. If we can explain that, then maybe we can sort of understand why it could also be that if you don't have axisymmetry, then it's got to be static. So why is that? Well, the answer comes from tidal physics. And the answer is basically the same answer as to why the Earth is spinning down, because the moon is not orbiting the Earth as fast as the Earth is revolving around its axis. So let's think of the following situation. So I'm going to think of the Earth and the moon, and I'm going to take the idealization that the moon is actually a stationary, on a stationary orbit. So, and that's not so bad, because what matters here is the comparison between the spinning, the angular frequency of the spinning motion of the Earth versus the orbital velocity of the moon. And because the orbital velocity of the moon is so much smaller than, it's a month versus a day, we can approximate the moon as being stationary. So here's the moon, here's the Earth, and here's the moon. And, later on I'm going to be replacing the Earth by a black hole, and then the moon will become some distribution of matter that's not axisymmetric. Right, so if we had a distribution of matter that's axisymmetric, so if we, if we're going to be producing an axisymmetric space-time out of it, it's got to be true that the black hole itself is axisymmetric, like Kerr. But it's got to be true also that the matter is axisymmetric, which means that it has to be evenly distributed around the axis of rotation. That is not a situation like this, where we have a concentration of matter here, and to have an axisymmetric concentration of matter, that moon would have to be replaced by, some kind of strip of matter that's uniformly distributed all over the phi angle. So that's not axisymmetric. And because it's not axisymmetric, well, it turns out that even in this very mundane situation, it's not stationary also. And what I mean by that is that, so we have the Earth rotating like this with some angular velocity. And it would be stationary if omega was constant. We would have a stationary space-time where nothing depends on time. But the Earth dynamics between the moon and the Earth makes omega decrease in time. So the tidal forces create a situation where omega decreases with time. And in this idealization where the moon is stationary, that will keep happening until omega goes to zero and the Earth stops spinning. And that would take us from a situation where we used to have rotation and we no longer have rotation. And it goes from a situation where it used to be stationary, but it's no longer, it becomes static. Why is that? Well, it has to do with the fact that the moon being there means that there's going to be a tidal bulge created on the Earth ocean. And if you work all this out, what you're going to find is that those tidal bulges over here, well, they have their own interaction, gravitational interaction with the moon, and that creates a torque on the rotating Earth that forces it to lose angular momentum and therefore lose angular velocity. So the tidal forces, and mostly it's tidal torquing, produces this situation. And if the moon is stationary, the endpoint of this is going to be where the Earth stops rotating. If we leave the moon orbiting, then the endpoint of that evolution is going to be where the Earth is rotating at the same rate as the moon is revolving. And that will be happening for the Earth. It's going to take millions of years to achieve. It's already happened for the moon. So as you know, the moon is always showing the same face. And that's because this tidal dynamics has been acting on the moon and has managed to tune the angular velocity of the moon to match its... So the spinning frequency of the moon matches the orbital frequency of the moon. So the tidal dynamics has already produced a stationary situation on the moon, and it's, you know, going, you know, and it's, you know, in time, it's going to produce a stationary situation around Earth. So that's the idea. If we have a black hole here instead, and if we have a distribution of matter that is not evenly distributed in angle, for example, suppose that it has, you know, a bit more matter here than anywhere else, well, that's very analogous to the Earth and the Moon situation. And this mass excess over here will raise a tidal bulge on the black hole, and there's going to be some interaction that, you know, when you work it out in detail, it's actually very close to the Newtonian description, even though it applies to black hole. And what you're going to find is that under a situation like this, omega H will be either increasing or, it's going to be decreasing. It's going to be decreasing until the black hole stops revolving. So you're going to go from the stationary situation to a static situation. If the matter distribution is perfectly axisymmetric, if, you know, the mass is evenly distributed in angles like this, then there's no tidal bulge because there's no excess mass anywhere in the distribution of matter. And that means that the black hole doesn't have any way to go, and it will stay like this forever. So with an axisymmetric distribution of matter, this allows for omega H to be constant, and that allows for a stationary situation to, you know, continue. So basically, it's all due to the tidal physics. That's very analogous between a black hole and the Earth. If you don't arrange the mass to be perfectly axisymmetric, if the mass is not arranged to be axisymmetrically distributed, then the black hole will either spin up or down. And eventually, you know, the end state of that will be a situation where the black hole is either going to be completely non-rotating, namely static, or if the matter was axisymmetric to begin with, or it may move toward that state, regardless, at the end of that process, we're going to reach a stationary situation with a completely axisymmetric distribution of mass. So bottom line is that when you allow for all of this relaxation to occur, if you have stationarity, you have either static spacetime or an axisymmetric spacetime. And if you have an axisymmetric spacetime, then according to Hawking, you also have a linear combination of the two Killing vectors becoming null on the event horizon and giving us exactly the same sort of geometrical structure that we encountered before. So pretty powerful. If I'm not mistaken, I think Hawking formulated this, of course, using techniques of mathematical physics. The underlying physical reason why it had to be so, that was worked out after the fact by himself and Jim Hartle, and then it was looked at over and over again. So the, you know, so the mathematical theorem was clear. The physical reason behind it, you know, took a little bit more work to unravel, but eventually I think the physics became pretty clear. And not that I had much to say about this, but I actually worked a lot on the tidal physics of black holes and sort of revealed a very close analogy between the Newtonian physics of tides and the black hole physics of tides. So the mechanisms look, you know, very, very similar. So it's a very interesting field of research, I think. Anyway, so for our purposes today and for the continuation of this theme, the important point is that if we have a stationary spacetime describing a black hole and a distribution of matter around it, it's got to be axisymmetric. So we're going to stick with the rotating situation, and we're going to take the black hole, the spacetime, to be axisymmetric, and we're going to have this null vector on the event horizon with which we're going to be working out all sorts of properties. All right. Any questions about this discussion here? Okay, so let's pick up the thread where it is, and we can develop it to a nice extent. I'm going to need stuff that I had over here. Yep, very good. Get rid of this over here. Okay, so at this point, what we said is that, okay, we assume stationary, then that leads us automatically, according to Hawking, to axis symmetry. And that leads us to the statement that a linear combination of the Killing vectors with the omega h quantity in front, I give it the same notation, but now it's no longer the same as the Kerr one, because the spacetime is not the Kerr spacetime, but it's still a constant. This is null on the event horizon. And because the event horizon is a null hypersurface, well, we automatically have the statement that this is tangent on to the null generators. And we automatically have the statement that it satisfies the geodesic equation in general form. All of that follows for free. So K being null guarantees that it's going to be tangent to the null generators, because we're dealing with a null hypersurface, and because the generators are necessarily geodesics, then we have automatically the geodesic equation, and kappa is going to be the surface gravity for this generalized black hole spacetime that's no longer a Kerr black hole. So we get all of that. But we get so much more. We get an awful lot more. And let's see. Right. Yeah, I'm going to spell out a few things. Yeah, I think I can do. Well, let's see how much I can do. Okay, so let's see what more we can say about all of this. So we're still relying on the stationarity idea. And because we have a stationary situation, now remember that, that theta was the fractional rate of change of cross-sectional areas. And if we're dealing with a stationary situation, then those areas will not change with time. So because, you know, if we're assuming, you know, if we're saying that the space-time is stationary, then that means that anything that would depend on, you know, anything that we would define on the horizon would be independent of time, and that means that it's independent of v. So stationarity means that dv of anything must be zero. If it were not zero, we would have a time evolution. But because we don't have a time evolution, then dv must be, you know, dv of anything must be zero. And, we can see what this implies, right? So a first consequence is that theta is going to be zero, because, you know, if theta were not equal to zero, we would have a fractional rate of change of cross-sectional areas. And because nothing changes with time, areas don't change with time. So what we have are perfectly, you know, constant behavior in terms of the null generators. So theta must be equal to zero. And that's basically stating that the V derivative of the cross-sectional areas must be zero if we have a stationary situation. So that's good. So we get that automatically from the stationarity assumption. And of course, we also get that the V derivative of the zero expansion is also zero by itself. So let's see what this implies. And we can look at Ray Chowdhury's equation and recognize that all sorts of things are going to be zero in that equation. And maybe we can identify a few more zero things. Ray Chowdhury, when we eliminate all the theta terms, basically we kill this, kill this, kill this, we're left with two terms. I'm going to add them together. We get that the square of the shear plus the KK component of the Ricci tensor, they must add up to zero. So stationarity gives us that. Now I'm going to mix in an energy condition. So what I want to claim here is that, well, this first term here is the square of a spatial tensor, so it must be non-negative. And what I want to do is to impose an energy condition that will guarantee that this component of the Ricci tensor is also non-negative. And if we have that, we have the statement that the sum of two non-negative numbers must be zero. I think you can do the math. That means that each term separately must be zero. So we're going to impose the null energy condition. The null energy condition, well, in terms of the stress tensor, that will guarantee that this is non-negative. But we can use the Einstein field equations to translate that into a condition on the Ricci tensor. And again, we get the statement that I made before, that the second term in Ray Chowdhury's equation must be non-negative. So if we combine the assumption of stationarity and the null energy condition, what we have is a statement that this plus that must be zero, and yet this and that must be separately non-negative. And that guarantees that they must be zero individually. So the assumption of stationarity tells us a lot of things, because it tells us that not only is the expansion scalar zero, it tells us that this shear tensor must be zero, and it tells us that this component of the Ricci tensor, or, you know, this component of the stress tensor of the matter, they must be zero as well. So just very simple assumptions with no knowledge of the metric describing the spacetime reveals all of that for us. And if we remember some of the equations that I wrote before, well, none of that is terribly surprising, because remember that the B tensor that we defined before was equal to the V derivative of the cross-sectional metric. If we have a stationary situation, the cross-sectional metric will not depend on V. So the whole tensor here has to be zero. The whole tensor can be broken down into a trace and trace-free piece. They're independent of one another. So if the whole tensor vanishes, it must be that each piece separately vanishes. So we have that theta and the shear tensor vanish. And now, as a consequence of Ray Chowdhury's equation, we have this condition on the Ricci tensor. So there are two flavors to this little argument. One is where we don't look at the full evolution of the cross-sectional metric. We're just looking at Ray Chowdhury's equation. And in order to conclude anything, we have to impose an energy condition. But if we went back to this relationship here between theta, sigma, and the rate of change of the cross-sectional metric, if we go back to a stationarity assumption, then we identify that each piece separately must vanish. And if we put that into Ray Chowdhury's equation, we get automatically that this must vanish. And in that version of the argument, we didn't need to impose the energy condition. I don't mind imposing the energy condition, because that turns out to be something we'll need to do anyway at some point to talk about other things. But it's nice to see that sometimes you need it, sometimes you don't. And it's always nice when you don't need it explicitly. And here's a situation where we actually didn't. So a lot is coming out. I think you can see that just by assuming stationarity, we have an awful lot falling out as a consequence of this assumption. And all of this falling out is basically an application of this formalism that we developed. And it's all, you know, basically based on the geometry of null surfaces. So once we have a stationary event horizon, all of this unfolds very directly. And maybe now you can start of, you know, see the point of building all this infrastructure that we did, you know, all of this technology that we spent some time working on is something that now allows us to do something very powerful with minimum effort. So that was, you know, that was the point of doing all of this. When it comes together like this in an application on black holes, I think it really reveals the power of all of this. So I think that, at least for me, justifies the time that we spent doing all of that stuff. Okay, so I think I'm not going to pursue this. I think I'm going to stop here because the next step here would be to try to unravel the consequences of that equation. And you know, just as a teaser, we can see that that equation also will end up reducing down to something very small. So the v derivative of anything vanishes, so we're going to kill that. Theta is zero, shear is zero, theta is zero, so we kill all of this. The only thing that we haven't killed is the angular derivative of the surface gravity being related to this component of the Ricci tensor, which can be related to a component of the stress tensor. We're one step away of having formulated the first law, the zeroth law of black hole mechanics, the statement that kappa for any stationary black hole must be independent of position on the event horizon. We know that it's going to be V independent because the V derivative of anything vanishes. So that one is coming out for free. But if we manage to say something about this and kill that, we're going to have the statement that this derivative vanishes. And that's going to be the statement that kappa doesn't depend on position on the cross section of the event horizon. And we're going to have constant kappa everywhere on the stationary horizon. So we're one step away of having this very important result, the zeroth law of black hole mechanics. And it's all going to hang on being able to rule out that contribution there. So that component of the Ricci tensor, we will argue, must vanish. But for that, we'll need an energy condition. So we'll need to impose an energy condition to kill that. And then we're going to have that being equal to zero. And then our work is going to be done. I mean, for the zeroth law. After that, we'll look at the first law and, you know, all of those other things that we can do, for, you know, based solely on the fact that we're dealing with a stationary spacetime. Okay, so I think that's enough for today. And we'll pick this up again next week. Any questions before we stop? Okay, good. So I'll see you next week.